What's up, y'all? This is Jeff Durbin with Apologia Radio at apologiaradio.com. Want to talk to you guys about an amazing connection that we have right now with Whitfield Theological Seminary. I want you to run over to whitfield.edu, whitfield.edu, whitefield.edu. I want you to check out the programs they have. They have undergraduate programs at Whitfield College, and they also have Whitfield Theological Seminary for the graduate degree and above and beyond. I think you'll really be impressed with the rigorous nature of the classes, the consistent biblical worldview taught and adhered to. I want you to contact Whitfield Theological Seminary at whitfield.edu. Get a hold of our friend, Dr. Kenneth Talbot, and start your classes today. ApologiaRadio.com.
Non-rockabotus must stop. I don't want to rock the boat. I want to sink it.
Are you going to bark all day, little doggy? Or are you going to bite?
Brett, delusional
is okay in your worldview. I'm an animal. You don't chastise chickens for being delusional. You don't chastise pigs for being delusional. So you calling me delusional using your worldview is perfectly okay. It doesn't really hurt.
She hung up on me.
What?
Desperate times call for faithful men and not for careful men. The careful men come later and write the biographies of the faithful men, lauding them for their courage.
Go into all the world and make disciples. Not go into the world and make buddies. Not to make brosives.
Right.
Don't go into the world and make homies.
Right.
Disciples.
I got a bit of a jiggle neck. That's a joke, Pastor.
When we have the real message of truth, we cannot let somebody say they're speaking truth when they're not.
What's up, y'all? Welcome to Apologia Radio. Get us at apologiaradio.com. From Phoenix, Arizona, 1360 KPXQ, Faith Talk, baby. That's Luke the Bear, Joy the Girl over there. What's up, y'all?
What
Hello.
Up?
Welcome back. So welcome back, Bear.
Guess who's back? Back, back.
Bear is back, back, back.
I'm back.
We got like a super episode planned for today.
It is kind of super.
It's awesome.
It's like Sábado Gigante.
Something we don't do often, but we've done before,
mm-hmm.
and that's a little tag team episode today. Tag team episode. Yeah. We're joining up with our favorite other show.
Yes.
Other show, and it's Backpack Radio,
mm-hmm.
otherwise known as
Fanny Pack Radio.
Mm-hmm. We're coming close to changing our name.
Are you really?
Just because of you guys.
Is it really going
to
happen?
And then you'll no longer be able, you'll have to think of some new pejorative.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What's kind of cool, because where you're sitting, I'm looking over, every time I look over today, so everyone knows, as I look over at vocab today, behind him is the fanny pack radio thing what'd you call it? The childish adolescent.
I think it's behavior. Your attempt at graffiti. It's as close as you got to being urban.
Yeah, we actually have sort of a backtrack for you today.
Oh, all right.
Just want to make you feel at home, okay?
Am I supposed to rap White and Nerdy?
Does he know the song?
Probably.
No, but
isn't that how you always rap?
No, they're all thinking I'm so white and nerdy.
It's pretty tight. Sounds pretty tight.
All right.
I'm supposed to rap along.
That's vocab. Tell everyone. Most of our listeners already know. Where can they go to listen to Backpack Radio, our one of our favorite shows? Go ahead.
Yeah, backpackradio.com. We've got almost 200 shows right now. Been on since October 2010. And our four-year anniversary is coming up, actually, in September 13th. We're actually bringing out Dr. Jonathan Sarfati, and we're going to have a little party.
Right on.
Sarfati.
Hey,
I always mess it up.
Aren't we joining in for this together, though? Aren't we doing something together with this?
I can't tell. It's inconclusive.
Yeah?
I don't know what you're doing, but you'll be there. I guess.
Yeah. Okay. We'll be in. Okay.
Yeah. All so right. It'll be at Roosevelt Community Church, 2 to 4 p.m. Saturday, and it'll be an awesome creation fest.
All right. So you've actually got a show kind of based on what we're talking about today,
mm-hmm.
in the can, ready for August or something.
Yeah. What happens is Bob's like a world traveler, so we have to record like 20 shows in advance so we get him in. So we recorded a show a couple weeks ago that'll air with Dr. Jonathan S. on August, whatever the first Sunday is there. So this is a prequel of sorts, but it'll air first. But prequels and sequels are awesome, right? Together?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, are you just not trying to cover yourself?
From my heart and from my hand, why don't people understand my intention?
So, I need to get...
I don't understand these pop references.
We're moving fast today. Today's show, in a sense, piggybacking together with Backpack's episode, is about science. You
sure
like
is.
It? You like my backtrack?
Yep.
Yeah,
boy.
It's cute.
So, today's episode is about science, the history of modern science. One a few episodes back, I had made a comment with context. There was actually context surrounding comments.
Oh, really?
Just a word kind of hung out in the air. It was actually context around it. It was a whole conversation happening. And in the show, let me go ahead and play the clip, actually. That'll probably best set this up. Let me see here. Here's two things happened. One, I played a clip from Richard Dawkins in his debate with John Lennox. And here's the clip that I played with Dawkins and Lennox, and I think their first debate.
Uses evidence to discover the truth about the universe. It's been getting better at it over the centuries in the teeth of opposition from religion, although it has to be admitted that, of course, science grew out of a religious tradition.
So that's a clip we played from Dawkins, and following Dawkins' statement there in that debate, here is a portion of the show that that actually is referenced to this clip. This is what I said right after that clip. All right, let's talk about that real fast. Although, and here's what Dawkins grants, by the way. It's true that science grew out of a religious tradition. You know, something you'll hear me say often in the lectures that I give is I talk about the foundations of science, things like induction, the universe can be studied, it's intelligible, all those different things. I say often that science, modern science, was birthed out of the Christian worldview. Right. All right. So what science was birthed out of the Christian worldview?
Modern science was birthed out of Christian worldview.
Modern science birthed out of the Christian worldview. Okay, so what took place after this is there's an atheist who I've taken out to lunch. I know him on a personal level. There's an atheist who wrote a note, and he said basically, and actually there's other things he put up too. Jeff Durbin's ignorance, the Christian worldview gave rise to science. And what he did actually is he pulled a quote from this show. After I said, in context, modern science, Christian worldview gave rise to modern science, he pulls a quote. He says, Jeff Durbin of Apologia Radio has been spreading false information. He is either ignorant or willfully ignorant of history. Jeff claims, and he pulls a quote that I said about 10 seconds after this, you cannot avoid the facts that it was the Christian worldview that gave rise to science. Context, guys, what was I talking about? Modern science. Right. Okay, so what he does is he basically, instead of, you know, taking a shot at the target that I set up, he turned around and shot some other direction. He proceeds to write a note talking about history, the Greeks, hundreds of years before Christianity, scientific innovation by the Greeks and everything else. So ultimately did not address really my point in the show. And he also didn't even reference for people where they can go to listen to the context of my conversation, which was developed and sort of explained in the sense of induction, logical consistency, integrity in discussion and giving evidence, and the Christian worldview providing the framework to make intelligible all those things, the pursuit of science.
And you were sort of piggybacking on Dawkins there.
Right.
I mean, that was also the context.
And not just Dawkins. This is important. So Jeff Durbin is ignorant, ultimately. And again, this...
He says you're stupid on purpose or stupid on accident.
Right, right. So ultimately, here's the important part to get. This note wasn't actually addressing what I said on the show. It wasn't in context, and it didn't even give actually a reference for anyone else to go hear it on their own. He took it out of context completely, shot in the wrong direction. And this is not something, and I mean this in as friendly a way as possible, that I don't expect from this particular atheist. There's a history here of name change. There's erasing old accounts with a persona that he had publicly, erasing that whole history. There's even comments he's made online, accusations against me in the past, that after making the accusation and me confronting him on it, he's actually apologized to me, removed it with no accountability. Not, you know, just like it didn't happen. It didn't happen. Not I was wrong and Jeff corrected me on this. But he did, even in this one note, in this one note after saying that I was ignorant, taking a shot in the wrong direction. He already changed the note twice. Once without notifying people because he was wrong in an accusation he made. He said that I was idolizing John Calvin and Luther when I've never actually even read a full book from either of them. I don't know how you can be accused of idolizing them. He changed it, and after I confronted the fact that he changed it without any accountability, he finally went in again and he edited it again to actually, you know, admit that he had made the change. At any rate, what's important here is that what we're discussing is framework, worldview, and what great gave rise to science. Here's what's really important. Check this out. Jeff Durbin is ignorant about science. Again, context was the Christian worldview giving rise to modern science, but it's apparently not only Jeff Durbin that is so ignorant about the history of modern science. Here's John Lennox in the debate with Dawkins.
Has science buried God? I think not. Science arose in the 16th and 17th centuries, a meteoric rise that historians of science have looked at and come to the conclusion that one of the main motors driving the rise of science was faith in God. So far from belief in God being a science stopper, it was the thing that caused science to rise in the first place, understandably so. Because people had a basis for believing that the universe was rationally accessible, and so they could do their science, which is apparently one of the reasons given by Needham, the famous sinologist in Oxford, when he looked at China and asked the question, why did science not develop in this way in China? And in the end, although he's a Marxist, he came to the conclusion that it was because of the Christian background. So I'm not ashamed of being both a scientist and a Christian.
So John Lennox, scientist, Oxford scientist, mathematician, professor, also ignorant about the history of modern science. So...
Yeah, Mr. White! Yes, science!
I just can't wait to play that clip. All right, so talk amongst yourselves. We'll get Dr. Sarfati on the next segment. Well, guys, what do you think?
Well, I mean, the real... ignorance comes from a desire to sort of rewrite history, because this is really more of a historical question, like a history of science specifically type of question.
Yes.
And I don't think it should be like up for grabs, like some revisionist critique is kind of like fair game, meaning all we have to say is what really happened. Let's talk about it. Why did it happen that way?
Yeah.
And not deny it. It's not. Some of these matters, it's sad that they become like so, I don't want to say politicized, but it's not that type of thing. I think an honest atheist could say, okay, so here's the context in which something that I revere came about in history. Here's the factors I think that led to it. Now let's move on about why Christianity is false or something like that instead of trying to rewrite things.
Right.
And here's the thing. If you're going to say this is like a totally false claim or something like that, you've got to postulate an alternate history about the rise of modern science. Okay, then tell us actually sort of how did it get here?
Right.
Why now? Why now specifically when it happened, the so-called scientific revolution? Tell us why it happened then. What were the conditions that were satisfied? What was the what was going on culturally? All that stuff. Tell us that instead of nitpicking at claims.
Right, and as an atheist supporting science, and you have to then show how the atheistic framework can actually give a coherent understanding of science and the application of science and everything else. You have to actually show that. As an atheist, I would think if you want to show that it just sort of hangs there. Be right back, guys.
Right back.
I've been here in my life, but who will in fact never see the light of day, outnumber the sand grains of Sahara.
All right, so we're back today talking about...
We are going to die. We are going to die. That makes us...
modern science. Yeah, that is Richard Dawkins dubstep. Yeah, admitted.
Dawkstep?
Yeah. Good job. Leave it to Luke to
That's
get creative like that. Talk about the rise of modern science. The show that we sort of gave a little bit of a snippet of a discussion on this was the show, it's somewhere in our archives, maybe three or four shows back, It's a big picture of Dr. White there, and it's Epic Debate Moments Part 2, I think is what it is. And I think that discussion that I had there on the back of Dawkins' comment was about 45 minutes or so into the episode, but the start of the second hour of the show. So you guys can go check that out. There's the reference for it. All right, so we're back. ApologiaRadio.com. You guys can get us there, get the past episodes, and share them on your social media. In your studio today with the bear, the girl, and Ice Ice Vocab.
Is that what you're going for these days?
That's Vocab Malone from Backpack Radio, guys. Honestly, how many shows do you think this is together now?
A dozen?
You think about a dozen?
I'll go with a dozen.
I think a dozen is good. We've done actually some really good shows. If you guys haven't checked it out, go to redemptionradio.podbean.com. Redemptionradio.podbean.com. You can check out a bunch of shows that Vocab and I did together. We even did some shows I thought very helpful on justification.
Yeah.
And stuff like that.
Nuthetic counseling.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
That was fun.
So, all right, guys. So we're back now. We're going to talk today with Dr. Jonathan Sarfati, which is not the first time we've had this brother on the show with us. He's one of my favorite scientists on the planet from Creation Ministries. You can get him at creation.com. Dr. Sarfati, welcome back to the show, brother.
Well, thank you for having me again.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure and an honor to have you on. We're going to move fast today. So just to introduce you to the audience, maybe who hasn't heard you before, tell us about yourself and what you do with Creation Ministries.
Okay, I'm the head scientist at the Creation Ministries International Office in Atlanta. I'm actually from Australia, though, and I was 14 years in the Australian branch of the ministry, which goes to 7 different countries. I've written a number of different books and hundreds of articles defending biblical authority, especially when it comes to the creation issue, the early chapters of Genesis.
Excellent. Excellent. And so I'm going to give everyone a recommendation here. Dr. Sarfati has written some excellent books. Have them in my library. I want to encourage you guys to pick them up at creation.com. Refuting Evolution, both 1 and 2. Excellent. Really easy to read and fun to read. And I love the way that Dr. Sarfati approaches the issue. And he's an excellent writer. And you just get a lot of really, really good information that'll be very helpful to you. Refuting Compromise, awesome. Love that. I think that was my first book I read from Dr. Sarfati. By Design is good. Okay, this is one of my favorites. The Greatest Hoax on Earth, Refuting Dawkins on Evolution, is a response to Dawkins' book on evolution, which is The Greatest Show on Earth. And if you could describe that for our listeners, Dr. Sarfati, because I think that's a really important one in light of what we're talking about today.
Right. Well, yeah. See, Dawkins is part of the world champion Darwinist today. Mm-hmm. And he's also a staunch atheist and uses Darwin to push atheism. Now, on the bicentennial of Darwin, which is 2009, he wrote The Greatest Show on Earth. Basically, here are the proofs of evolution, because he admitted his previous works didn't actually prove evolution, but assumed it to be true. So here he was going to give the knockdown arguments, and everyone thought it was a great book, and basically the end of the creation. So I had to refute the arguments point by point. On all sorts of issues like design, supposed bad design, the fossil record, human origins, and in fact things like the Christian roots of science covered in my last chapter.
Yes. So I want to make just a recommendation to all of our listeners. If you've ever thought through these issues and you understand the bankruptcy of the atheistic worldview and the borrowing capital from the Christian worldview that often happens, but you want to engage the issue for your own understanding of the fossil record and what are their greatest proofs and evidences, and that's sort of an area you want to get into, I want to highly recommend that work from Dr. Sarfati. All right, guys, so let's dig right in. Dr. Sarfati, one of the exciting things that I think one of the things for me that's exciting to engage in as a Christian is to look at the history of what God has done in his people and through the work of his people. Mm-hmm. in many different respects, conversion of nations, missionaries going into places and changing whole entire nations and cities and towns and all the rest. But one of the things that I find really thrilling and exciting is to look at the impact that the kingdom of God, the Christian worldview has had on our history in all areas, but specifically this area of science. If you were to begin a discussion with somebody to show the Christian worldview giving rise to modern science, where would you take a stab? Where would you start?
So I almost want to say, well, what makes science possible and desirable? See, Einstein was no believer, but he said that a priori we once should expect a chaotic world which cannot be grasped by the mind in any way. And he thought of it as almost a miracle that the world should be comprehensible.
Yeah.
And then you have around the same time A.N. Whitehead, who was a good friend of Bertrand Russell, arch anti-Christian, and he basically said the reason that science grew up was because of the medieval insistence that God was rational and personal and active. You see, otherwise, could any natural phenomenon be the act of an irrational despot God, and like the ancient Greek gods, or some impersonal, inscrutable origin of things, like in the New Age beliefs? You see, he thought, and he was no Christian, but he thought it was the Judeo-Christian concept of God as rational and personal was vital to actually have the idea that the universe itself is comprehensible and obeyed laws.
That's very important. And if I could just take a stab, I want to hand over to you guys maybe to jump in on this. One of the things important to look at is to look at the framework in the mindset as the Christian church is advancing through history, the gospel is going forth. You have underpinnings now setting underneath people that are giving people an understanding of the universe and the world that's just taken ultimately for granted, like the rational intelligibility of the universe, integrity and discussion as a moral absolute, you know, sort of hanging above every person in science, and all the things that are basically the framework of the Christian and biblical worldview that was underneath people. And I think what's interesting here, Dr. Sarvadi, I'm going to take a stab at this, is the beginnings of this, getting into the rise of modern science, begins somewhere that most people don't really understand, and that is in the Middle Ages. Oftentimes in our culture, atheists are they propagate a belief that you have the Dark Ages, dun dun dun, and you know there's nothing that came out of the Dark Ages. It was exactly right. What we think the Dark Ages. Talk about that for a second.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. The Dark Ages, when this is the area where you have big advances in logic, science, the cathedrals of Europe, which are brilliant pieces of architecture. You have the paintings of Giotto, which were revolutionary. You have the poetry of Dante, which is a totally new ground. And the idea that somehow these were dark ages, when in fact they were a huge advance in many different ways: prosperity, agriculture, human rights, well in advance of what the Roman Empire was like, where the Roman Empire was exploitative, had slavery, while the Middle Ages abolished slavery for in Europe.
Wait a minute. I thought that the church was burning atheist scientists at the stake during the Dark Ages.
Well, in fact, even an atheist actually has challenged any atheist. Okay, name a single atheist who has burned at the stake for science. In fact, they can't name a single person burned by the church or persecuted by the church for science. And quite to the contrary, there were many clergymen who were scientists. Like Orain was a bishop, and he proposed the idea that the Earth was rotating 200 years before Copernicus. Nicholas of Cusa was a cardinal who proposed the same sorts of ideas. No conflict with science or the church.
Excellent. Dr. Sarvadi, hang on to that. I'm on vocab to kind of cross-examine you in just a moment here. Be right back. ApologiaRadio.com.
Apologia Radio will be right back.
Appetizer, drawing the mess like a moth with that fire, calling an appetizer raw. That type to call them cats, vipers, dodge the wrath like the car. Mad hyper calm, I'm trying to rock that. Truth in
what up,
stereo,
what up, what up?
Get a hot track.
You are listening to Apologia Radio. And I know I'm not your normal voice. This is Vocab Malone, guest sitting in with Joy, Luke, Jeff. I don't know what their nicknames are, but I'm chilling in the studio with them. Of course, you can check out their website at apologiaradio.com. Right?
That's right. That's right.
Make
yeah.
sure you don't get it wrong.
And yours at backpackradio.gov.
You got it, man.
.gov.
.gov, yeah, sure. And we're just chilling here today talking to Dr. Jonathan Sarfati.
Yes.
I get it right?
Yes.
Who'll be coming into town September 13th. And so far, we've been discussing what are the necessary assumptions for scientific enterprise to happen, as well as some little forays into the actual history of science, such as the misnomer of the name, the Dark Ages. Even the Middle Ages is not that great. Personally, I'm a roll with medieval times, medieval era. I don't know if there's some better name. But Dr. Sarfati, I'm going to throw a couple of other presuppositions of science, and maybe you can just comment on them. This is from an older book, 1986, called The Galileo Connection by Charles Hummel, but he brings in a couple things that I think are important to talk about what is necessary for science to happen and for really even for people to believe that it could happen. One, order in nature. There's patterns, there's regularities. We talked a little bit about that. Uniformity of nature, that there these forces are uniform throughout space and time. What happens in one lab and one country will also happen in another, given the same conditions. Number three, the validity of sense perception, that we can actually have reliable data that we can interpret by human sense, you know, like reading a thermometer. Mm-hmm. Fourthly, simplicity. Usually the simpler explanation is to be preferred. And that's a general principle. Some of these are methodologies. Some are general principles. And fifthly, even moral responsibility, that the scientists themselves would accurately report their findings so it can be passed on to others as we do research. Comment on any of those presuppositions that are necessary. They're almost sort of articles of faith for scientific enterprise. Comments.
Well, okay, for instance, Buridan in the 14th century, so this is late Middle Ages, he thought that God would arrange things in an elegant way, even though, of course, God could do what he wanted. He thought that God would do it elegantly and simply, and that's why he thought it's simpler if a tiny Earth rotated rather than the vast cosmos revolving around it. So here's a case where the Earth rotating view was motivated by belief in divine simplicity and elegance.
Yes.
Right, yeah, and I mean, There's this, I mean, you even hear sometimes like a, say, an atheistic mathematician or some of the theoretical physicists when they talk about some of the equations behind the reality that we see, they are often struck by the grandeur and sort of the elegance of the computations, the sort of inherent beauty of it. And it's interesting. It's like God, in a sense, is poetic via these numbers. I mean, you know, I'm giving interpretation on it, but it's interesting, and even the fact that numbers kind of make it all roll, you know, this universal language God has instilled in all of creation.
Well, man, as I quoted before, Einstein thought that that if you're an atheist, the first thought you should have is the universe was chaotic, and yet this is not what we have, but this is what one would expect from atheism. While you have Descartes saying that God was perfect and acted in a manner as constant and immutable as possible, so he believed that God would be a faithful lawmaker, a God of order, who would actually run the universe in an orderly way. And Arame in the 14th century, God gave humans reason. So we should be able to discover the things that God has done. And it's because we're made in God's image, therefore we should have the rationality that God has.
Now, what do you think of this comment? This is from the book, The Genesis of Science.
Who's that by?
It's a James. How do you pronounce his last name? Haman, the God's philosopher's author. Same.
Right.
Guy?
Yes. Yeah, I've read that one. Yes.
Says the central. The central idea of the medieval worldview was that everything and everybody had a purpose. Nothing just happened. Nothing existed purely for its own sake. The ultimate governor of the universe was God, and He had endowed everything with a reason for its existence. End quote. How relevant do you think that is to this discussion for people to realize?
Extremely. It's a very good book. I know it by the title in Britain called God's Philosophers. I think it has a different title in America. I'd forgotten about that one. But, yeah, I think he's totally right. And his book's very helpful because it goes through a lot of these medieval scientists and what they discovered and how Galileo and co. built upon discoveries discovered by the Middle Ages 200 years before them.
Yeah, and that author actually brings up the point that Galileo and some of these guys were genius, but sometimes they didn't fully give credit, meaning a lot of people sort of did think Galileo came up with all this stuff on his own because he didn't say, hey, this is from some dudes before me.
Right, right.
Which would have been nice because this is a trail of progress. This isn't overnight.
That's right. Can't look at history atomistically, just these, you know, particles floating around, but everything is there's a unity to it all and a background that we have to grasp. So we're right back, guys. ApologiaRadio.com.
Apologia Radio will be right back.
In order for science to work, in order to be able to engage it in a coherent way that makes sense, there are certain things that need to be underneath you. Assumptions that we all just take for granted. But the question is, can you just have those? Or in your belief system, can you provide the preconditions necessary to make a pursuit of science intelligible? Get to ask that question. Not ask the question. This is important for atheists to hear. We're not asking the question, what are we doing? But can you account for what you're doing? So, for example, in science, you have to assume the rational intelligibility of the universe. You have to assume that the future be like the past. Induction has to hold. Has to hold.
Right.
There must be integrity. There's an ought, ultimately, over the head of every scientist as they engage this. Is there not?
Mm-hmm.
Ought they not tell the truth? Or is that not above them? Or do you demand it of them? And if there's an ought above them about integrity in the sense of investigation and gathering evidence and actually telling somebody about the evidence that you found, is there an obligation for integrity and truthfulness in that pursuit or no? And does your worldview provide for you the preconditions necessary to make sense of that need for integrity? You can't just say, well, we just think it's a good idea. Well, so what? That's arbitrary. There's no ought above you there. Laws of logic. These are not made of matter. They're not material in nature. Do you have a worldview that can make sense of that? And so when you think about the rise of modern science, I want to say that the advance of the kingdom of God, as Christendom is moving throughout history, you begin to see the framework is now in place for people to be able to make sense of these things. In history, of course, people had observations and they made advances, but not the kind of scientific moment that we had in the 16th and 17th centuries and beyond,
mm-hmm.
as a result of what was built underneath these people. For example, just throw this out there, guys. I think it's important to look at. So I was doing some looking around, and just for fun, on Science 2.0, it's a website. Science20.com is actually how you get to the website. Has the list of the top 10 schools for science. Top 10 schools for science. You've got Yale University, University of Wisconsin, the University of Michigan, Columbia University, Cornell University, Princeton University, Harvard University, California Institute of Technology, University of California, Berkeley, MIT, Stanford University. Okay, that is today in Science 2.0, their top 10 schools, colleges for science. Interesting, if you take a look at the history of those current top 10 schools of science and look at their history, you'll find something rather interesting. So when I say the Christian worldview gave rise to science, take a look at this. Currently top 10 schools, look at this. Number one, Yale, their motto, light and truth. This is from Christianity.com. It may come as a surprise that when Yale University was founded on this day, October 16, 1701, it was by Congregationalist ministers unhappy with the growing liberalism of Harvard. It wasn't called Yale then, of course, but rather the collegiate school. The ministers donated 40 books and declared their objective that the youth, quote, may be instructed in the arts and sciences who through the blessing of God may be fitted for public employment both in church and civil state. More. Listen, students are required to, quote, this is a quotation now, live religious, godly, and blameless lives according to the rules of God's word, diligently reading the Holy Scriptures, the fountain of light and truth, and constantly attend upon all the duties of religion, both in public and in secret.
Mm-hmm.
Ready? Quote, consider the main end of his study, to wit, to know God and Jesus Christ, and to lead a godly, sober life. Mm. Yale University. Columbia University, their motto, in thy light shall we see light, which is a direct quote from Psalm 36:9. Mm. And further, Cornell, the origin, A.D. White noted in his inaugural address of Cornell, we will labor to make this a Christian institution.
Mm.
A sectarian institution, may it never be, i.e. non-denominational, but we will labor to make this a Christian institution, Cornell. Princeton, the flag and original motto. Ready? The flag of the university displays the school's shield and motto. The open book is inscribed with Vet Nov Testamentum, Old and New Testament. The motto translates as under the protection of God, she flourishes. Princeton's origins, founded by Presbyterians. Harvard's original motto, Truth for Christ and the Church. Listen to this. This is from Harvard's original rules and precepts. Listen. Let every student be plainly instructed and earnestly pressed to consider well the main end of his life and studies is to know God and Jesus Christ, which is eternal life, and therefore to lay Christ in the bottom as the only foundation of all sound knowledge and learning. And seeing the Lord only giveth wisdom, let everyone seriously set himself by prayer and secret to seek it of him. Proverbs 2:3, and we can go on. Stanford's origin, Stanford said in their original proclamation to prohibit sectarian instruction, but to have taught in the university the immorality of the soul, the existence of an all-wise and benevolent creator, and that obedience to his laws is the highest duty of man. At least the foundations there. It's amazing. Cambridge, Oxford. Founded in 1209 Cambridge, Oxford, founded in at least 1096. The motto of Oxford, by the way, the university that Richard Dawkins was trained at, the motto of Oxford is the Lord is my light. You can't deny the fact that it is, in fact, the biblical worldview that framed all of this, gave the foundation, made it coherent. You cannot deny it. And I agree with Vocab. Vocab, I agree with you fully. I think the answer here for an atheist is not to engage in Horace historical revision.
Yeah, I mean, what's the need? Let's just talk about what happened, what it is, and then go from there. But, you know, this even the concept of university, really, I would say assumes a comprehensibility and a uniformity of knowledge and information. What I would ultimately say assumes a monotheistic, omniscient God. Now, it's kind of a discussion to have about how that is. But if you think about even the rise of the universities, you know, these are 12th and 13th century things when you see these centers of learning arise. And I mean, a lot of them, like, for example, the University of Paris grew out of cathedral schools where Peter Abelard taught. And if you look at that, it's interesting. And I mean, for example, why do you dress the way you do at a graduation and a coronation? You look like a bunch of medieval scholars. Yeah. That's why people, because that's the historical epic it came out of. And, you know, these people were in university talking all this anti, you know, God gibberish, but they're dressing like dudes who were there to, like, learn about God and learn Greek and Hebrew and all this. Yeah. It's just not only is Christianity, maybe you want to say Christendom, the parent in a lot of ways of science, it's also still to this day its friend.
Yes, that's right. Dr. Sarfati, your comments.
Well, yes. I mean, the university was one of the inventions of the so-called Dark Ages, and they were modeled after the theological colleges of the area, and they were designed to be an international community of scholars. So they could present the truth about the universe, and they were free to criticize some of the ancient Greek dogma, which was rife in those days too. Again, because they believed God is free to create as he pleased. He didn't have to do what Aristotle said he had to do. So we find big advances in those, and the American founders, of course, wanted to preserve that tradition of these institutes of higher learning, which were meant to be in service of Jesus Christ.
Yes,
as you document it.
Now, obviously, there have been when we would say because the image bearers of God will not cease being image bearers of God, even when they deny him and they go off into, say, worship of other gods. There have been advances in history of observation and mechanics and all the different things we look at in science, and because these are image bearers of God, we would argue, of course, you can't escape that in God's world. But for some reason, it doesn't get off the ground in these other cultures. Can you give us some examples of that and maybe explain why do you think that was, that history did not experience the pop? Science did not experience the pop that it did until Christianity gave really the groundwork.
Okay, a good book written this year, Rodney Stark's book called How the West Won, talks about some of these things. Like, for instance, there are certain Chinese who invented a very good way of smelting metal, but then the empire basically confiscated that and nationalized the industry. So therefore, that industry disappeared in China because of the rapacious culture of the leadership. They invented gunpowder, but then they never made use of it because their culture just didn't have the idea of rationality. Gunpowder was just one of those fancy things that happened. Only a few hundred years later, about the 1500s, the Europeans were already well ahead in the use of gunpowder for firearms.
Yes.
So again, okay, you can have certain invented. Paper is another one. It was only the Middle Ages that automated the production of paper. Paper was made in China, again, as a curiosity, but the Middle Ages took it seriously and mass-produced it with water power because they realized how important it was.
Yes.
Now, this is a little bit tangential, but Dr. Sarfati, have you considered or heard about the relationship between general capitalistic principles and scientific progress? For example, if you have slave labor, which is cheap, you don't necessarily need to find such a quick and efficient means of production because the cost is not such a factor. For example, if people don't get to keep what they earn, then they don't have such an interest in doing all this stuff, not just working harder, but all these inventions. And because, you know, agriculture is also a big part of medieval progress and sort of agriculture science. That if you don't get to keep as much, you're not as interested in saying, well, how do I mass produce this and what's the quick?
So, well, Robbie Stark points, he does mention that whole thing. But the Romans certainly knew about wind power, but they didn't care because they had slaves. They could plunder other people, get slaves, and do it for them.
Yeah.
It was only the Middle Ages abolished slavery in Europe, and therefore they had to develop these labor-saving devices. And because they could keep the fruits of their labor, they had an incentive to develop more and better ways of doing things.
Right.
Yeah, so there you see, if basic capitalistic principles, if someone believes those are connected to a Christian worldview as well, you even see sort of economic theory and political theory being relevant to scientific flourishing. And even just be able to ask questions, sort of this sort of open, what should be an intellectual, honest climate comes out of I would say, principles that have to do with, again, the integrity of people, their value, their worth, you know, the fact that they're image of God bearers. And so there's a whole nexus of factors that go together. And I don't know as much about this. Maybe you want to comment, but I've even heard some people say that the Protestant Reformation, as it got back to an emphasis on objective truth, and as it got away from sort of the Greek high and mighty, let's sit around and think about the world, and got more into it's honorable to dig ditches for the glory of God kind of thing, as they kind of got into that, that actually led to more experimental science instead of just thinking about it. Do you think there's something to that thesis? I don't know quite yet if there is, the Reformation connection.
Well, Peter Harrison, who's a historian of science at Oxford, he has written a whole book about the Protestantism and the rise of modern science, pointing out how a literal understanding of the Bible was vital to develop modern science. That's what he says very clearly. The thing is, before the church got very corrupted, in fact, you have the same Judeo-Christian principles applied in some of the monasteries in the Middle Ages as well, developing these things. So the general Christian worldview, but see, the Reformation was really recapturing what the Bible had always taught. There was nothing really new in the Reformation. It was just recapturing from the accretions of church tradition, going back to what the Bible really said. But there were people earlier than that who applied those principles and developed capitalism, science, and the like in the Middle Ages as well.
Excellent.
And I've heard that originally the Royal Academy was comprised of a lot of sort of bivocational kind of clergy / scientists, but of as the professional, quote, career scientists came to rise, there was an effort to kind of do away with those kind of guys.
Well, that was much later, around the time of Darwin and Huxley. Huxley wanted to do away with the Christians and science with his X Club, but the thing is, see, Stark has compiled a list of about 52 scientists from Copernicus to 1680, so these are about the Reformation time, and he shows that 60% of them were not just religious, but devoutly religious. Most of the others were ordinary religious people. They went to church, they weren't anti, they weren't really especially devout, and only one of them was a skeptic. In fact, even that's doubtful as well. Halley was accused of being an atheist, but he actually wasn't. He was a close friend of Newton, who we know was extremely devout, the greatest of all of them.
We'll be right back, guys. Hang on to that, Dr. Sarfati. We'll be right back after this break. ApologiaRadio.com.
How many books do you know of that address topics of education and welfare, local government, state government, taxation, money and banking, free markets, courts, war and the military, and the executive power? How many books do you know? actually talk about these topics from a biblical perspective and set forth all of the issues, ideas, the history, and the hurdles, and the blueprints for the way forward. Hi, I'm Joel McDermott with AmericanVision.org. In Restoring America One County at a Time, I cover all these topics and more, showing you how America was once free, how those freedoms were lost, and giving you an uncompromising biblical approach to get those freedoms back. I focus on practical steps, local solutions, personal sacrifices, and it has a multi-generational vision. So don't just sit around talking about restoring America. Actually do something. And you can start by getting my book, Restoring America One County at a Time, at AmericanVision.org.
This is Jeff Durbin with Apologia Radio. Get us at ApologiaRadio.com. The profanation of marriage is gaining legs within our culture with the same-sex marriage debate. This is, church, a gospel issue. We have to be salt. We must be light on this issue of same-sex marriage.
This is Joy Temby with Apologia Radio. I urge you guys to pray for the homosexual community, then log on to realharmony.org to equip yourselves with the resources we've provided.
This is the Ministry Bear. Here's the issue. The same-sex attracted community has a symbol that's universally recognized. It's an equal sign. You see it everywhere. Until now, the Christian community has not had a symbol that represents true, harmonious, biblical marriage. Go to realharmony.org and buy a sticker. They're $3 a piece. Get your church to buy them by the truckloads. Help us redeem the culture. And let me reiterate, this is not a political issue only. This is a gospel issue. Realharmony.org.
Luke, I am not your father. You are listening to Apologia Radio. Here are your hosts, Luke Bearwalker.
I'll never turn to the dark side.
J2D2. And J3TO.
Use the comb lint. Oh my.
And vocab, does it make you jelly? Does it make you jelly?
Well, I'm trying to figure out which one of you is R2D2 and which one of you is C3PO?
I have to be C-3PO. Have to be.
Well, so here's the thing.
For whatever reason.
Yeah. It really seems like you, because of the fact you're male.
Yes.
And I guess R2-D2 is a male, but it seems like more like he doesn't
he's
need to be.
He's way cuter. So he should be, he's the more girly.
And C-3PO is kind of the one who talks a lot. 6 million form of communication,
right?
And is like, oh, you know, you're that's pretty much, I totally agree with you. That's pretty much you,
he's
Jeff.
Like, oh.
And she's like quiet but determined, and like, I'm not gonna say like short and stocky, you know, or anything
right, like that.
R2,
right?
But I've seen her head spin around,
yeah,
and I've seen it flash red. Her eyes.
And I make weird little noises.
And so you always get the job done, though. Like, you may not say as much. You'll cuss when you need to, but you tend to, because that's what R2D2 does. You watch your language,
yes,
you know.
Yeah.
But I definitely am to say you're more like R2D2. You're more like C-3PO. And Luke, I don't know what you guys call him, but he's not Luke Skywalker. He's Chewbacca.
He's a Chewbacca.
What
yeah.
the?
I know.
Yeah. Right.
See,
okay.
I think there's some confusion because your name is Luke, so
yeah,
that's
okay.
where I think the it comes in.
Well, we did it because the names worked out well. So
yeah.
You can, in your own
you know
mind,
what?
Yes, science.
You know what? You can just go back to your own show.
Which I'll
yeah,
be happy
Mr.
to
White.
Do.
Dude, you just told
yes,
you
science.
Just, this is two episodes in a row where we just took a strange turn into nerddom.
Yeah, it's all right.
Wait, you're the one playing Star Wars clips and all this. It's not
my
fault.
How can you resist?
Yeah, there you go. Can't resist. All right, so check it out. Additional historically Christian universities, Cambridge, Oxford, and you move forward and you look at University of Pennsylvania. The Charity School of Philadelphia owes its existence to the vision and efforts of Reverend George Whitfield. Brown University. Brown was the Baptist answer to the Congregationalist Yale and Harvard, Presbyterian
okay.
Princeton and Episcopalian Penn and Columbia. Rutgers University established to train young men for the ministry in the Dutch Reformed Church.
Interesting. Okay.
Dartmouth College, the Reverend Eliezer Wheelock, a Congregationalist minister from Connecticut, founded Dartmouth College in 1769.
Eliezer Wheelock. He's like a totally, he made a cameo in Weird Al's Amish Paradise.
Did he really?
He totally did.
Oh, that's awesome.
Just because.
All right, so here's the deal. Listen, We have to talk about, and this was the context of my comments in the past when I've done lectures and even on the radio program. Listen, the biblical worldview gives you the very preconditions necessary for all of life. Obviously, our argument is Romans chapter 1, everybody knows God, but they suppress the truth about him, and so they cannot help being God's image in God's world. So they suppress the truth about God, but ultimately they cannot cease being image of God. So they will appeal to logical consistency. They will appeal to integrity in discussion and in debate. They will appeal to a rationally intelligible universe and that they can predict based upon past experience, future events. But, you know, you can't have that with this sort of worldview. Listen to the atheistic framework and you'll understand why it is in history. You will not find universities such as the ones I've quoted from or referred you to, you will not find atheism giving rise to these universities. You don't find schools founded on the name of atheism because you can't get it with this framework. Here's Dawkins. Well, that was going to be Dawkins. Let's try to get the sound going here. This is Dawkins. Well, no.
All right, okay. Let's talk. The picture that science presents.
Well, let's try this. Let's not go with Dawkins. Let's go with Krauss. Here you go. Here's Krauss. Oh.
The picture that science presents to us is in some sense, uncomfortable. Because what we've learned is that we are more insignificant than we ever could have imagined. You could get rid of us and all the galaxies and everything we see in the universe, and it'll be largely the same. So we're insignificant on a scale that Copernicus never would have imagined. And in addition, it turns out the future is miserable. So the two lessons that I like to say I like to give is, first, we're insignificant, and second, the future is miserable. Now, that should depress you, but I would argue that, in fact, it should embolden you and provide you a different kind of consolation. Because if the universe doesn't care about us, and if we're an accident in a remote corner of the universe, in some sense, it makes us more precious.
Does it now?
Wow. I think I missed the connections there.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about that for a second. There's Krauss describing a couple things. Number one, the universe does not care, Dr. Sarfati, and we are accidents in the universe. Now let's talk about briefly how that cannot give you science.
Well, that's the thing. It's what Einstein said. If we're accidents in the universe, then the universe itself is accidental, and therefore anything that we observe in nature could be accidental as well. There's no reason why there should be any repeatability, any order in an accidental universe. His view cannot give rise to science. He's being irrational. In fact, he's cutting off the whole branch he's sitting on with his ideas.
Absolutely. Okay, so Pastor Luke, you got something you want to say?
I think I was listening to one of your lectures, actually, Dr. Sarfati, and I believe you were talking about talking about university and stuff. I think you were saying that it was either when students would go for I think it was a science degree, they had to take theology as well, or it was the other way around.
Theology was a big part of the medieval university, but in fact, most of the leading scientists of the Middle Ages were actually clergymen.
Mm. Oh, yeah, I think I've heard someone talk about how when these guys would go to study theology, philosophy, they like science was required.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about? Because I think I've heard that, too.
Yeah, I think that was what
like
it was.
Like a lot of the medieval universities, yeah, it was a requirement. Right. And, I mean, they were steeped in it. I mean, if you look at their logic, like Peter Abelard, or how are you – I always mess up his name, too. That's my thing, messing up last names.
It's okay.
You're an incredible logician as well. I mean, stuff is that they're actually quite relevant today as well.
Dr. Sarfati,
Krauss is wrong on another area as well, because he says that somehow it's a modern discovery that the Earth is tiny compared to the universe, but that was very well known to the medievals as well, because you have Boethius wrote The Consolation of Philosophy in the 6th century, and that was one of the best sellers of the Middle Ages. And here's a quote from Boethius. He said, "As you have heard from the demonstrations of the astronomers, in comparison to the vastness of the heavens, it is agreed the whole extent of the Earth has the value of a mere point, that the Earth will be judged to have no volume at all." This is in the 6th century, so Krauss is saying nothing new.
Right.
Yeah, sounds like Pale Blue Dot, just
right,
an earlier version.
Very much so.
And yes, science!
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I mean, therefore, why should we be concerned about silly earthly plans? Why should God, because compared to God, I mean, our own godless little plans are totally insignificant, because the whole planet is a tiny point compared to the vastness of the universe. And that was supposed to be one of the consolations of the philosopher in Boethius' book.
Well, can we take a brief rabbit trail, can you respond to this? Sometimes an atheist will say, well, we're not like you guys. When we see something, a mystery we can't figure out in nature, they would say, we roll up our sleeves and get to cracking. You guys just sit around and say, well, God sure is mysterious. Check it out. You know, and just sit there and marvel at it with your small minds. We do the work. Is that really true?
Oh, I mean, come on. This is what the medieval and the Reformation science were trying to do, is work out what laws were being done, not just God did it in some mysterious way. That's the Islamic view, which is why Islam never gave rise to science. But the medieval people were trying to find out what sort of laws was God using. And that's the key difference between real science and just phenomena. So, I mean, these people don't even understand the Christian concept of God as a rational creator.
Very much so, yeah. And just that the point of dominion over the earth, God giving us dominion over the earth, the understanding that there's such a thing as providence, that God is sovereign, and that he actually carries events along to their intended destination, that the universe cannot be just looked at in a sense of chaos or accident, that actually we can clock it, we can test it. We can trust it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Quote, Kepler, these guys would agree that Kepler was a great scientist. And this is what Kepler said. He said the chief aim of all investigations of the external world should be to discover the rational order and harmony which has been imposed upon it by God and which he revealed to us in the language of mathematics.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, a brief comment that in the book, The Genesis of Science, he makes about Kepler is this, quote, there was no imprecision about God, and he did not make 8-minute mistakes, nor was he the capricious sort who would make the heavens into an unsolvable puzzle. If the paths of the planets were ordained by God, then they must be simple and elegant. In keeping with his faith, Kepler was absolutely unwilling to abandon the axiom of uniform motion. And they talk about how Kepler's sort of commitment to the fact that it would be able to make sense is what drove him, even when all the data hadn't fit yet, and it was sort of a big puzzle to be solved. He said, no, God did it rationally. I'm going to figure out how. This gets to the point of to even think that science is possible and to sort of have an unshakable faith in the nature and character of this dependable God and this rational God is what drove some of these men to say, let's push it. Let's push it. There is an answer. Let's push it. I mean, especially when you read Newton's stuff. I mean, some of these guys, it's crazy. You read their stuff and like every other line's like a prayer or devotion in the middle of like math. You know, I mean, I did that too, but it was for a different reason. God, help me not get this wrong when I guess. But anyways.
Yeah. And it was Newton that actually had some great commentaries on Daniel and Revelation. And people have often said, and I've heard this in numerous places, that Newton was the most religious man of his century amidst a lot of competition. There was some heavy competition for most religious guys, and he was intensely religious and devoted to Christ.
Dr. Sarfati,
and the thing is, over half the great scientists of that time were not just religious, but quite devoutly, in the sense that Newton wrote more about the Bible than he wrote about science. I mean, Kepler, I've quoted for you. You have Robert Boyle, who funded the translation of the Bible into other languages, with his own money. So it's not just going to church. It was a case of going above and beyond what was sort of generally required to be considered a Christian. That's over half the people who are the stars of science in those areas at that time.
And I think it's really important to demonstrate that it's not just that they happen to be Christians. It's that the biblical worldview and framework gave them the tools necessary to do what they were doing. And I got to say this, if you believe what Dawkins says here...
It's quite clear, I think, that the cardinal didn't really understand. But that, you know, we are actually descended not just from apes, but we're descended from fish. We're descended from bacteria.
If you believe that about human beings and the world we live in, you cannot have an ultimate coherent justification for the pursuit of science. Atheists live on borrowed capital as image bearers of God. And we're going to hear more as we get back with Dr. Sarfati from Creation Ministries International at creation.com. Vocab Malone from Backpack Radio, The Girl and the Bear right here in the studio, ApologiaRadio.com.
Apologia Radio will be right back.
I liked one phrase you used there. You talked about the sort of society in which we wish to live. And I'll tell you quite freely that a society based upon Darwinian principles is exactly the sort of society I do not wish to live in. Mm-hmm. It would be a terrible society, mm-hmm. it would not. I do not wish to live in a Darwinian world. The world of nature is a Darwinian world. It's a very unpleasant world. It's a thoroughly unpleasant world, not the kind of world we wish to live in. So let us understand it so that we can construct the kind of society in which we wish to live, which will be a non-Darwinian society, with a sort of society which departs from Darwinian principles. A society that was based on Darwinian principles would be a ruthless free market economy in which the rich trample the poor, in which it would be a sort of opposite of a liberal socialist society, in fact.
Well, there you go. Professor Richard Dawkins, trained in an historically Christian institution, Oxford University, founded at least again 1096 AD, motto, "The Lord is my light." It does not want to live in a society governed by Darwinian principles, and understandably so.
Wow.
Here's an example of somebody not living consistently with, I think, their framework. And I think it just displays something, not in a sense of mockery to Dawkins necessarily here in this moment. I want to say something. Atheists cannot live consistently with their presuppositions, with their professed beliefs about the world. You see, you can say that human beings are just apes that are descended from fish, that are descended from bacteria, but you cannot live that way. You can say the universe is an accident, but you cannot live that way, do science that way. Dr. Sarfati?
Well, it's interesting that in an earlier talk he said something like that a Darwinian society would look like Nazi Germany. He said that. Of course, now that's not politically correct to say that, but that's what he said a number of years ago. And more recently, he's been calling himself a cultural Christian, would you believe?
Huh.
Well, I got something on that, Dr. Sarfati. Listen to this.
Yeah.
I'm not one of those who wants to stop Christian traditions. This is historically a Christian country. I'm a cultural Christian, the same way as many of my friends call themselves cultural Jews or cultural Muslims. So, yes, I love singing carols along with everybody else. I'm not one of those who wants to purge our society of our Christian history.
Now, I don't believe that, because I've listened to Dawkins for years.
Yeah.
I've listened to so many lectures, and I don't know what was going on in this interview, if he maybe had a little couple drinks before he did the interview. He was just feeling really soft and loose or something, because I've seen him say exactly the opposite in lectures.
Yeah, he said that teaching Christianity to children like his mental child abuse.
Right,
yeah. Did. And Krauss did the same thing.
Right.
Yeah, and according to Hitchens, there's that story where I think Dawkins asks him if you had the ability to sort of eradicate from the planet everyone that had Christian ideas in their head. Not kill them, but they would just no longer be around, or somehow we could wipe that out through reason. And there was one more there, and you were with them hanging out looking, and you could convert them right then to non-Christianity. Would you be able to do it? Would you want to do it? And Hitchens says, it's in the Collision DVD, he's talking to Doug Wilson, he says, no, I wouldn't want to do it. And he says that Dawkins looks at him incredulous, like, you know, why the heck not? And Hitchens is all reflective. Maybe he had had some drinks, too, there. And he's like, it's not just because I wouldn't have anyone to argue with, although it would be partially that. There's something else, and I don't know quite what it is. You know, I'm paraphrasing, but interesting comment there.
Yeah. I don't think that obviously they can live consistently with what they say about the world, but there's something that they would feel as a loss. Like, can you imagine Dawkins singing, like, Joy to the World?
That'd
the
be awesome.
Come. It would be really cool. And I think the reason why it probably resonates with him is just because I think that he realizes if he lives consistently with what he believes, that there is no beauty, art, there's no,
right.
there's nothing. That's why he wouldn't want to get rid of Christianity, and obviously acknowledges England is a Christian, has a Christian origin as a nation, and so did also his university, by the way. But I think the atheist realizes how much of a loss there would be to all of life if they actually live consistently with what they say.
Mm.
If our ancestors were bacteria, think about the implications. Dr. Sarfati, I think I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about history, the things that didn't get off the ground. Talk to us about the Islamic Golden Age.
Well, in fact, the Golden Age is a complete myth, because all the so-called Islamic advances were actually advances from the Dhimmis, the conquered people. Like, for instance, you think of a lot of the great Arabic scholars, for instance, Omar Khayyam, you have Al-Khwarizmi, the founder of algebra. Now, they were Persians, not Arabs, okay? A lot of the other leaders in Islamic medicine were actually Nestorian Christians, not Muslims. You have, for instance, the Dome of the Rock. That was Byzantine architecture. A lot of the mosques, the most famous mosque, the Hagia Sophia, that was the leading Eastern Orthodox cathedral. So again, they were basically copying from their conquered people. Now, when they became less tolerant of the non-Muslims and expelled them or killed them, those dhimmis took the advances with them, and therefore you have what looks like a collapse of the Islamic Golden Age, but there never was any Islamic Golden Age to collapse. Okay. It was the dhimmi Golden Age, and they just took it with them and left the Islam as backward as it ever was.
Mm. Yes. Okay, so now let's move into further the rise of modern science. Let's talk mm-hmm. about how as Christianity provides the framework and the groundwork necessary for science really to be given its real true birth and pop. What did it look like? What happened? Like, lead us into that discussion as Christianity sort of feeds in the biblical worldview. Christendom is spreading and everything else is going on. Christianity is a dominant worldview of the West, both England and America. What did it look like? What are the advances? Tell us about it.
Well, I mean, it first started in things like a lot of the technology that was totally new, a huge advance of the Roman Empire. Then you have big advances in mathematics and in physics, and then that led to experimentation in chemistry. Now, that was Robert Boyle, the father of chemistry. He rejected alchemy and turned it into real chemical science. He discovered Boyle's law for gases, for instance. Then you have people rejecting the idea of spontaneous generation like Pasteur and realize that life only comes from life. And that really refutes evolution completely, because evolutionists believe that life came from non-living chemicals. Now, we wouldn't have modern medicine if we thought that life would spontaneously generate. There's no point to have antiseptics because the bacteria could just grow again.
Yes.
So you need that for modern medical advances, the idea that bacteria come from outside and don't not spontaneously generated. Then you have advances in a lot of other things, like even antibiotics. You have Ernst Chain, who is an Orthodox Jew, anti-Darwinian, who invented penicillin and got the Nobel Prize, shared the Nobel Prize for penicillin. So you go to any branch of modern science you care to think of. Linnaeus in biology classification. You see, this was pre-Darwinian, anti-Darwinian, and that was he was a creationist. So every branch of science that you can think of had Christian underpinnings to it.
Yes, and Francis Bacon, 1561 to 1626.
He's my favorite.
Yeah? Bacon? Yeah. Bacon's your favorite?
He didn't invent bacon.
Oh, shoot.
Well, there was a Roger Bacon much earlier in the 13th century who did work on optics and invented the spectacle. Now, Francis Bacon's an interesting one because you have Peter Harrison writing a whole book called The Fall of Adam and the Birth of Modern Science, I think is what it's called. Now, he said that Francis Bacon was trying to recapture what the pre-fall knowledge of Adam would have been like. So Bacon believes in a historical Adam, historical fall, and believed the fall also affected our intellect. And his project with modern science was to try to recapture some of that pre-fall intellect.
Right, and he wrote, there are two books laid before us to study to prevent our falling into error. First, the volume of the scriptures, which reveal the will of God, then the volume of the creatures, which express his power. Francis Bacon, 1561 to 1626, Lord Chancellor of England.
Mm-hmm.
He's the man that considered to be the man primarily responsible for the formulation and establishment of the so-called scientific method in science. All right, guys, we got more to come. ApologiaRadio.com.
Apologia Radio. Right back.
I see a little silhouette of a man.
Scaramouche, Scaramouche, will you do the fandango?
Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo, Galileo,
Galileo, Galileo,
Figaro.
Magnifico! I'm just a poor boy, nobody loves me.
He's just a poor boy from a poor family, sparing his life from this monstrosity.
All right, we're back, guys. Joy the Girl, Luke the Bear, Vocab, our buddy over at Backpack Radio. Get him at backpackradio.com, .gov. Also, the show airs on Sundays. What is it, at midnight, Vocab?
6 p.m.
Is that from 6 to 6:30?
That was a good thing when you guys switched your church services to the morning. You started getting a lot more people because before, you're missing out on this right. segment of people who are listening to our show instead of going to your church.
Right, right.
Because they told me that it was twice the fun and double the content. Kind of like our show compared to yours.
Oh,
like when I was coming here, I told my wife, babe, I'm running late. I got off work late. I think I'm going to miss the first 20 minutes of the interview with Apologia Radio, and I'm stressing out. And she was like, don't stress out about it. I was like, why not? I'm running late. They're going to start without me. She's like, well, they don't do anything the first 20, 25 minutes anyway over
there. That's true.
So I said, oh, okay, thanks, babe.
It's true.
My wife's real supportive. So
yeah, we usually
you're just jealous, dude.
We like to have fun. All right, guys, we're back. And Galileo played that special clip there. Dr. Sarfati, tell us about the conflict with Galileo and maybe it sort of address some people's misunderstandings of that event.
Well, the main misunderstanding is that Galileo was science versus religion. It was nothing of the sort. In fact, it was more science versus science because the scientific establishment of his day was devoted to the Aristotle and Ptolemy view that Earth was at the center of the universe. And Galileo's discovery was undermining that the scientific establishment. That's a big thing. Now, when it comes to the church at first was quite encouraging of Galileo because, after all, it had a Rheim and you had Copernicus saying the same things before Galileo. So they were quite happy for Galileo to publish his ideas as proposals. Unfortunately, what Galileo then did was actually put a few arguments of his friend, the Pope, into the mouth of Simplicio, the fool, in his dialogues. His dialogue had a fool character, and he put this Pope's arguments into the mouth of the fool. So you have getting offside with the Pope, who was once his friend and promoter. So you have the two main things there with science versus science, and then a bit of papal personality politics was a thing there. The church didn't really care about Kepler. Kepler was fine. The Lutheran church was fine too with Kepler. And after Galileo and the Pope had died, the Jesuits were teaching Galileo's ideas to Chinese astronomers. So in fact, the church had nothing in principle against what Galileo was teaching. In fact, Galileo was actually the master of his own undoing in many ways because of his abrasive personality. He seemed to be oblivious to the fact that he was actually hurting his friend, the Pope, in what he was doing. And then the church did make a blunder of trying to marry the science of their day with the Bible, like reading Aristotelian Ptolemaic concepts into passages that weren't even talking about. Like Psalm 93 said the world is firmly established, it cannot be moved, okay? Now, the word for move is also used in Psalm 16:8, which says, I shall not be moved. Now, the thing is, it doesn't mean that the psalmist is in a prison straitjacket.
Right.
It means he will not falter, you see. So it wasn't talking about physical motion. But the thing is, the church made the mistake of reading the Aristotle ideas into the passage, but wasn't talking about it, and then using it to say that Galileo was attacking the Bible. Now, Galileo never wanted to attack the Bible. He was quite devout himself, okay?
Right.
Yeah, I actually got a quote here from him from this Galileo Connection book I mentioned.
Right.
This is a quote by Galileo. The Holy Bible can never speak untruth whenever its true meaning is understood. And right. So he accused his opponents of hiding behind like a religious shield, but he said that this is my paraphrases of some other stuff I've read of his, that mm-hmm. it was fabricated, meaning it wasn't the right interpretation, that they were using a bad interpretation of the Bible to protect their bad science was basically his argument. I mean, didn't he dedicate the book to the Pope or something?
Well, yeah, the Pope encouraged him to publish it, and Cardinal Bellarmine was quite happy to entertain the idea too.
Yeah, so it's sort of science versus science and ego versus ego.
Oh, very much both of those things. And you can just show what happened. You see, Copernicus had no trouble. You see, Kepler had no trouble. Orame and Nicholas of Cusa had no trouble hundreds of years before Galileo.
Well, do you have anything else to say about some of those passages people have used to say, look, the Bible teaches geocentrism? Any other, because I think that was a helpful way that you explained that one. What are some of the other ones?
Well, the other one is, for instance, the Joshua's long day, the sun stood still. Now, the thing is...
Dr. Sarfati, I want to hear that. We're actually going into a commercial break right now, and I don't want to miss this full explanation.
Okay.
So hang on, guys. We're gonna get to that next passage in just a moment, guys. Join with us in this movement at apologiaradio.com by giving. Click on the donate tab. Join with the work of Apologia Church. We'll be right back, apologiaradio.com.
is Apologia Radio, and I am Vocab Malone of Backpack Radio. I've been graciously invited here by my friends Luke, Joy, Jeff, and a couple kids. I don't know who they are. They just wandered in here.
Orphans. My kids are here. Sage and Sailor are here today. What's up? You want to say hi? Come say hi. This is Sailor.
Yeah, I like bacon. That's all.
She likes bacon.
Wow, I guess
Francis Bacon.
Yeah.
Yes, and Roger too.
Sage, will say something?
Kevin Bacon?
Oh,
ah, well done.
Hello.
He's good.
That's my son, Sage.
He's a robot.
Yeah. All right.
So we're talking today about sort of the historical relationship between Christian worldview specifically and the scientific enterprise, you know, modern science. And we've discussed a lot of things, different inventions, theories behind inventions, ideas, laws. I mean, it's been wonderful. It's been beautiful. And just a second ago, Dr. Jonathan Sarfati of Creation Ministries International was breaking down the real relationship of what happened with the Galileo affair. And because that's commonly brought up as just like when the church got it wrong here. And first of all, we're reformers, so we're down with the Reformation. We're not Roman Catholic, but we still see the general sort of big ideas. I mean, a Roman Catholic worldview of the universe is closer to a genuinely Christian worldview than
it's Christian
atheism.
Worldview.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As far as the kind of big thing. So you were about to say, well, here's some other passages that have been misinterpreted for so-called proof from the Bible of geocentrism, the idea that the earth is in the middle and everything revolves around it. One you discussed about the earth shall not be moved, and you're about to get into Joshua's long day. Break it down.
Which is, I mean, Joshua 10, it talks about the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and hasted not to go down for about a whole day. And that's supposedly support for geocentrism, the earth. The sun is what's moving and the sun is what stood still. But you see, even before Galileo, Bishop of Rheims in the 14th century said that, I've got a quote from Rheims actually, which should be quite interesting for your listeners, where he says, by saying that this passage conforms to the normal use of popular speech, just as it does in many other places, which aren't to be taken literally. We talk about sunset today. A planetarium today uses a geocentric frame to illustrate the motions of the planets. You see, we talk about sunset. Why can't the Bible talk about sunset?
Yeah, what's the technical term for that? Phenomenological language?
Phenomenological. It's language of appearance. And Nicholas of Cusa, a cardinal in the church, a bit after Orem, he said that no matter where you are, your own, where you are seems to be unmoving and everything else seems to be moving around you no matter where you were. So if the earth was moving, we'd still consider it as the earth being stationary from our reference frame. So you have 200 years before Galileo, cardinal and a bishop actually answered the very objections that were thrown against him by saying, well, this is just ordinary language of appearances, phenomenological language.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the answer. And the Bible does not teach that idea. There's other passages, too. I don't know. I mean, before we move on, do you want to say anything in general about sort of misinterpretation of biblical passage in relation to...
Well, I mean, I think the church and Galileo teach exactly the opposite from what the Long Ages wanted to tell us, because, in fact, the trouble the church went into was to try to marry the science of its day with the theology, and so they got widowed the next day when the science was overturned. I think this is what a lot of people want to do now. They want to try to twist the Bible to fit Long Ages and evolution. So I think they're making the same mistakes as the Roman church made with Galileo.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Good point.
Right. All right. Pastor Luke.
Yeah. So I was hoping to talk a little bit more about just, we briefly mentioned at the beginning, just the kind of the revision of history. And we saw in the Nye-Ham debate, Bill Nye just refusal to like acknowledge any Christian scientists at all. And I personally kind of think that actually might be kind of the death blow of this new atheism, just the refusal to acknowledge that scientists, that are Christians, even exist. And it was evident in that debate. So I was just hoping to hear you talk a little bit kind of where you think that started, where that came from, and just the effect it's having today, even in apologetics.
Well, for instance, in the Enlightenment period, which is a bit of an after Newton's time, I call it the Endarkement period, you have people who are not scientists like Voltaire and Hume and Diderot who are trying to say that science made the Bible impossible. But none of these guys were scientists, and none of these seem to be aware that the scientists they appealed to were devout believers. And then you have, in the 19th century, the invention that the church believed that the earth was flat. And that was a complete invention designed to discredit Christian opposition to Darwin. Never cared that they were lying through their teeth about it. In fact, it's almost a joke today to this flat earth idea, because almost all the leading clergymen affirmed the earth was round. So that's the one big myth that Dawkins still used, and so does President Obama use, actually.
Exactly.
Even though it's a complete lie.
Yes.
And now, of course, it's almost admitting, denying that Christians can do science, even though I hope that Bill Nye never has to have an MRI, because that was invented by a creationist, a young earth creationist, Raymond Damadian, and Ken Ham showed a clip by him affirming his young earth belief. Now, he was the one who really made MRI possible by discovering the signal change that tumors would have under the MRI.
Right.
Well, in fact, it wouldn't be imaging without Damadian's discovery.
Yeah. Well, and ultimately, if we think about the presuppositions of atheism, what's assumed about us, our origins, life, the world, reality, everything, there's really no standard that's necessary for them to hold to. So historical revision isn't really a problem. And ultimately, if they live consistently with their principles, they don't have any obligation whatsoever to tell the truth.
Yeah.
It might be a preference of theirs to tell the truth, but it's ultimately arbitrary. Which, by the way, I'll play a little clip here from Dawkins being interviewed by Justin Brierley of Unbelievable Radio, speaking about rape. Here's Dawkins really being honest about the implications of his worldview.
Don't you immediately step yourself outside of this evolutionary process and say there is the reason this is good is because it's good, and you don't have any way to stand on that statement?
But my value judgment itself could come from my evolutionary past, and I suppose...
So therefore it's just as random, in a sense, as any product of evolution?
Well, you could say that, but it doesn't in any case, nothing about it makes it more probable that there is anything supernatural.
Okay, but ultimately, your belief that rape is wrong is as arbitrary as the fact that we've evolved five fingers rather than six. I mean,
you could say that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if rape, as something that is wrong to do, can be just arbitrary in the atheistic framework here, the evolution, the what do they call Dawkins, the Darwin's bulldog? Isn't that what they call him today or something like that?
Yeah. Right,
if he says, you know, ultimately, yes, it's an arbitrary decision to say, you know, this is evil, as arbitrary as, you know, five fingers rather than six, then ultimately I want to ask the question, what gives me any confidence in you as a scientist?
Yeah.
If your moral framework, because of your pre-beliefs, is that rape as an evil thing is just ultimately arbitrary and not really evil, then what kind of confidence can I have in listening to what evidence you provide to me?
Mm. Yeah, but telling the truth is arbitrary as well. It's arbitrary as telling a lie. So why, under his own belief system, he could be lying through his teeth and it would be perfectly consistent with his belief system.
That's right. It's all about framework here. It's all about what are the preconditions necessary to actually make any of our experience intelligible. And the fact of the matter is all of us do know God. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. And what happens is, when the fool says in his heart, there is no God, he goes off constructing very complex systems that ultimately are built on sand. And so Dawkins, clearly, I love to listen to Dawkins. I listened to Dawkins probably 3-4 hours in the last 2 weeks. I love his accent. I there's times I really, really like the guy a whole lot. I actually love listening to him. I love how he can explain things. He has a real gift for explaining things. But his system is a house of cards at best, easily blown over the very moment there is any questioning, deep questioning of his system. When you have a universe where we are just the result of a universe that doesn't care, blind and purposeless forces acting on matter, that we are just, and he said it, apes descended from fish, descended from bacteria, and you have morality ultimately based and just hung in midair based on nothing, and it's just totally arbitrary. Again, you don't provide the framework necessary for science, and you just show the foolishness of your belief system. You're just borrowing from Christianity to make sense of your world. And I think it just, and I'll leave this here, I think that it needs to be pointed out that Dawkins lives and breathes and moves in a world ultimately gifted to him by Christianity.
Hmm. Yeah.
A culture handed to him by Christendom, and trained in a university that was given mm-hmm. rise by Christianity, the biblical worldview.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, he sounds like this.
I don't know why you always have to be judging me, because I only believe in science.
Dr. Sarfati, do you have anything else you want to say?
Well, I mean, basically, Dawkins' worldview is parasitic on the Christian one. That's all I can say about that.
Yeah, it's parasitic. Exactly right.
Well, what about this? I don't know if we have time to go there, but sometimes in these discussions, you'll hear an atheist bring up maybe ignorant or out of context or naive or aggressive statements sort of against the scientific enterprise by early Christians or, say, one of the reformers. For example, a famous one is the supposed off-head comment by Martin Luther against Copernicus, recorded in Table Talk, but no one really knows if it's authentic. That's an example. I mean, what do you say about some of those comments? Because I don't think we would want to say that we're saying, so yeah, all Christians throughout the history of the church have had a proper, positive view of what science is and should be. I mean, how do we process those kind of comments that are brought out?
Okay, I discussed Luther in my book, Refuting Compromise, that quote you're talking about. Now, mm-hmm. the thing is, I mean, it's not as if Luther was a campaigner against Copernicus. If that's right. The only recorded statement was in his offhand comments recorded after his death, it's hardly a concerted campaign against Copernicus' sun-centered worldview. Otherwise, he would have been doing it all the time. All I could find is that one comment, and in fact, what Luther said is that he who wants to seem clever has to produce something new, and he was criticizing innovation as he saw it. He wasn't criticizing because it was necessarily against the Bible, but really because it was something different from what had been accepted previously. That was his real objection. Now, if you look at his book, The Bondage of the Will, he was very much into logic. He actually took Erasmus down for being irrational.
Yep.
And Luther wanted to argue rationally and logically from the Bible. You see, so he was a master logician, not at all opposed to proper use of reason and science.
Yeah, it seems that he wanted to be convinced by Scripture and plain reason. Whether or not that exact quote is true, it seems that was his general ethos. I mean, a couple quotes by Calvin. Again, you know, these aren't scientists per se, but I find this interesting. This is from the Institutes. He says, "If we regard the Spirit of God as the sole fountain of truth, we shall neither reject the truth itself nor despise it wherever it shall appear, unless we wish to dishonor the Spirit of God." And mm-hmm. then one more quote by Calvin from his commentary on Genesis, and maybe then you can say something, Sarfati. "For astronomy is not only pleasant, but also very useful to be known. It cannot be denied that this art unfolds the admirable wisdom of God."
Very good.
Sounds like something the psalmist would write, you know?
I think so. I mean, when you think of also the Reformed churches, I mean, all the ministers of Reformed churches had to be tested for their skill in logic before they could become a pastor. So, I mean, they've held logic and reason in very high regard.
Exactly. You know, I one thing to say about all this.
That'd be...
Yes, science!
That'd be interesting on your interview when you're like before your pastoral candidate. We just have some small logical tests we're going to run by you to see if you. What are the three classical laws of logic? You know, that'd be fun.
All right.
But today, in my opinion, actually, yeah.
Yeah. Instead, right. Does your wife play the piano?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Can you do a potluck? Organize it. All right, guys, this has been Dr. Sarfati from Creation Ministries International with Vocab Malone, Joy the Girl, Luke the Bear, and me talking about the rise of modern science. Dr. Sarfati, you've been a gift and a blessing as always. Everyone, go over, check him out, creation.com. And Dr. Sarfati, real quick, what's the new book?
The new book is called Evolution's Achilles Heel. I've just seen a copy of it, and it should be out very soon in the stores, in the creation.com store anyway.
Excellent.
Evolution's Achilles Heel.
Excellent. We'll be right back, guys, next week, ApologiaRadio.com.
On shot first.
It's true.
Hi,
Hi, this is Jeff Durbin, host at Apologia Radio, also the pastor at Apologia Church. You can get us at apologiachurch.com. We have officially moved to Sunday morning services. We want to invite you to come and worship with us. 10 a.m. Sunday mornings, southwest corner of 60 and Rural at the Embassy Suites. We are committed to worshiping Christ in spirit and in truth, and to building strong biblical families, and to expositional through the Bible teaching. Please join us for worship as we work towards the exaltation of Christ throughout the world.
This is the Ministry Bear, also discipleship pastor at Apologia Church. The location we're meeting at is the Embassy Suites at 4400 South Rural Road, and that's in Tempe. Again, we're meeting at 10 o'clock a.m. on Sunday mornings. Please join us, apologiachurch.com.
Embassy Suites, 10 a.m. Sunday mornings, apologiachurch.com.